Hello, it's Tuesday the 23rd of September. I'm Belinda Rhodes. In today's podcast, we hear the latest from the Labour conference in Manchester.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Friedland. I'll be looking at what it'll take for the Prime Minister's critics to back off and get off his back. And we'll have comedian Eddie Izzard offering some useful tips.
As the landscape continues to change on Wall Street, will Americans soon be taking money out of Goldman Sachs cash points?
What it means for the banks themselves is that they will be able to go into a much broader range of business, and it means we will have Goldman Sachs branches, for example, across America.
And what exactly went on at Stonehenge before the famous blue stones arrived? Archaeologists shed a little more light.
The little bits of firewood prove that there were people lighting fires at this site 7,000 years BC. It's just extraordinary.
That's all coming up, but first today's headlines and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
In spite of last week's government promise to bail out bad property loans, the US stock market has started falling again. Prices in New York went down by 3%. The Asian markets followed suit. It seems traders are not sure whether the bailout of billions of dollars will work. It still has to be approved by Congress. Meanwhile, the oil price went up sharply by up to $25 a barrel, and currency dealers started marking the dollar down on the exchanges. Gordon Brown's making one of the most important speeches of his political career at the Labour Party conference. He'll try to turn round the loss of confidence in his leadership. The Guardian's been told that he will promise to extend the welfare state with more help for children and carers looking after elderly or sick relatives. We'll have more on this later in Guardian Daily. Hundreds of Royal Mail engineers and security staff are going on strike today. They plan to stay out for 3 days in a dispute over working times. Although they don't directly affect postal deliveries, they will have picket lines at mail centres around the country. In China, the head of the food safety watchdog has resigned over the baby milk scandal. Both dried baby milk and fresh milk have been found contaminated with a chemical called melamine. 53,000 children are reported to have become ill. Many thousands are in hospital and 4 babies have died. The United Nations General Assembly is opening in New York. President George Bush will make his final speech. Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will also be speaking a day after the head of the Atomic Energy Authority reported he cannot be sure if Iran is hiding some nuclear activities. In Britain, researchers say they believe they've found the meaning of Stonehenge after the first excavations in 40 years. They believe it was a healing centre similar to Lourdes today. We'll hear the full story later in the programme. Three papers lead with a story of a father in Southampton who killed his daughters before committing suicide himself. Before he died, he's reported to have phoned his estranged wife to tell her that her children had gone to sleep forever. That's the headline in The Sun and The Mail, while The Mirror asks, how could he? The Guardian devotes the whole of its front page to the Labour conference and Gordon Brown's speech today, including a sketch from Simon Hoggart that says things can only get worse, referring to the Chancellor's gloomy speech. The Financial Times tries to explain why the American markets are falling again. It says fears have emerged that the government's bailout of bad debt to cost $700 billion may not be enough. On the back pages, there's a range of stories, including recriminations about Britain losing the Ryder Cup in golf. The Mirror believes that Mike Ashley's found a buyer for stricken Newcastle United. He's been approached by a group of wealthy Nigerians who have already pulled together millions of pounds. More on the day's news plus breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
It's the second day of the Labour Party conference in Manchester, where yesterday's senior party figures tried to cool leadership fever ahead of Gordon Brown's speech today. More now from The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland, who's there.
Obviously the focus of the day, the leader's speech, the big address, only the second one Gordon Brown has given. Big pressure on him, inevitably people describing it as a make or break speech. Some people believe that it's very possible the speech could break him. Rather fewer people believe it could make him. So deep is the hole he's in. But we'll come back to that in a moment. Yesterday, though, it was the day for the Chancellor to have his moment in the spotlight. Alistair Darling, not a man that you normally associate with the spotlight particularly. He did his turn. In a way, it was the very opposite of what normally an effective political speech would be. It wasn't in any way rousing or stirring, no kind of barnstormer. And yet, perversely, it was almost exactly probably what a Chancellor should do, especially in a moment of financial and economic crisis like this one, because it was calm and soothing and very solid. And if it was a little bit dull, that's fine, because the markets will have wanted dull, calm stability.
I will introduce a new banking reform bill in the Commons in a fortnight, strengthening the supervision of the banking system, making it easier to intervene if a bank gets into trouble, giving new powers to the regulators. We're also going to put in place measures to give added protection to savers.
So that was Alistair Darling, absolutely meeting expectations and requirements by being slightly dull, which was exactly what was in the script for him. Next up in the afternoon yesterday came the Foreign Secretary, David Miliband. Now, the pressure on him was almost exactly the reverse, at least from his supporters. They did not want dull. They wanted fireworks and really the kind of speech that would have delegates leaping to their feet, exhilarated and rushing to embrace David Miliband as their saviour. If that was their hope, the speech didn't quite deliver that. It was, I think, almost deliberately, actually, not a barnstormer. He didn't tear the roof off, because that would, I think, have been looked would have looked too much like an act of aggression against Gordon Brown, too much like a leadership bid. Instead, the signals were slightly coded. He did a few things that normally people only do if they're delivering a leader's speech. So, for example, David Miliband gave a little slice of his own personal backstory, talking about his father and grandfather. That's not part normally of your bog-standard cabinet minister's speech, but he did it almost as if it was slightly like the leader's speech. And there was a few moments where he took on David Cameron directly. "Answer me this, Mr. Cameron," he said. Well, again, normally it's the leader's job to take on the leader of the opposition. So there were a few subliminal messages of ambition in this speech, and some of them went down very well.
Of course government is tough. It's meant to be. Every day we have to prove ourselves, rightly. But the toughest day in government is 10 times better than the easiest day in opposition, not for us, but for the people that we represent.
One of the treats of being at a Labour Party conference, or any party conference actually, is doing some off-piece, non-political celebrity spotting. You get extra points if you spot celebrities who aren't actually part of politics. So far it's been a bit slim, the pickings this time. I saw Tony Booth, Cherie Blair's father and the former actor, saw him around. And, you know, in the past you would spot Kevin Spacey if you looked closely enough. He was often around in the last couple of years at Labour Party conference. He used to tutor Tony Blair, apparently, in his speech delivery. This year it's not quite as Hollywood as that, but one man around, and Labour supporter himself, comedian Eddie Izzard, and he's got a few tips for Gordon Brown.
I've got a sticker on my chest, so that's how it's starting off. But obviously it's going for a fourth term, and it's not only saying let's go forth for a fourth term for the Labour government, which I think is the right thing to do, but it also implies let's go and have sex and go forth and multiply. So I think both sex and a fourth term for a Labour government is probably a good thing.
So this is a reprise of Lorna Fitzsimons' famous line in 1997 that you get more sex under a Labour government.
Yeah, I think it's true though, isn't it? I know Gordon's got a fight in his hands. He's got to come out fighting. It's his Battle of Britain time. He's got to fight like crazy.
Do you think he has a problem connecting, a problem communicating?
He may have. He's got to get better at that.
And does he need good jokes and things like that?
I don't know. I think, yeah, just being more relaxed, that kind of thing that, you know, Hillary Clinton, when she started, you have to be yourself. There's an interesting thing, actually, I could say here, that General U.S. Grant said in the American Civil War. He said all these generals in the American Civil War, they were trying to be Napoleon. Everyone was trying to be Napoleon, who was 1815, and this was like the 1860s. So they were all trying to be that brilliant Napoleon and Battle of Austerlitz and all that kind of thing. He said, you can't be. You actually have to be the brilliant version of you. So Gordon's got to take everything that he has and make that work for him as best he can, as well as he can. And you can't become someone else. So he just has to work with himself. And that's the same with everyone. And Tony Blair did that, and Margaret Thatcher did that, and Winston Churchill did that. Everyone has done that. You have to become the best version of you that you can. And so now's his time. He's just got to fight like crazy.
Eddie Izzard speaking to The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt. remember that he's the only Prime Minister to be a doctor. He did have a doctorate. He is Dr. Brown. Now, I know that was an academic doctorate, not a medical one. But if he did decide to play the role of Dr. Brown, I think that could be rather helpful for him. His first step, as any good doctor will know, is to diagnose the problem. And I think what he should do is try and explain to people exactly what this financial meltdown and this economic crisis is all about. Calmly, the Scottish doctor, that's a persona that people like, very calmly and coolly explain to people why this trouble has happened. Next step is to offer a remedy or a cure. I think he needs to say two or three tangible big things that he and the government will do to either deal with the economic damage or prevent it happening in the future. And these mustn't be these little small bore tiny initiatives, the equivalent of lagging for your radiator pipes at home. I think he needs to come up with something quite big to say, okay, I've told you the problem, the diagnosis, here's the remedy, it's something big. And I think if he does that and does it in a tone that suggests command of the subject, this is after all his natural territory, the economy, he's on home turf with this, he will allow people to leave the conference with a sense that he has got, that he is in control, that Gordon is going to steer us through this. That solidity and reassurance, which was always part of the Gordon Brown persona when he was Chancellor, I think if he could convey some of that by being the Scottish doctor telling us how we can get through this current trouble, this ailing economy, I think that would do him a lot of good. The expectations on him, or the necessity to perform well, are very, very high. So you can add that to the memo from Eddie Izzard, all that advice raining on the Prime Minister's head. But that is the task for Gordon Brown, and that's going to be the focus of all eyes and all attention here in Manchester.
And that was Jonathan Friedland at the Labour Conference in Manchester. And of course, you can read updates on that story on our website at guardian.co.uk/politics. And elsewhere on the website today, as the campaign for the White House heats up, read and watch reports and comments by our writers and sign up for our daily email election briefing at guardian.co.uk/US elections 2008. At Comment is Free, William Gumede says Thabo Mbeki's resignation was the dignified action of an old-school party loyalist. And an unusual destination for ornithologists. Read about why the Basra red warbler is attracting bird spotters to Iraq. That's at blogs.guardian.co.uk/environment. So, while the Labour government continues to try to find ways of surviving amid the shockwaves of the world financial crisis, Washington and Wall Street are working together to try to prevent total collapse. But the $700 billion bailout package set out by the US government last week is causing concern amongst both Democrat and Republican politicians. And the announcement early on Monday that investment giants Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley are to become holding banks has completely changed the traditional landscape on Wall Street. Our business editor Deborah Hargreaves has more on that momentous step.
Well, it's a very significant move because it takes away the two remaining big investment banks on Wall Street, the two big remaining independent banks. And it reverses a whole era of legislation which has separated investment banking from retail banking. What it means for the banks themselves is that they will be able to go into a much broader range of business. And it means we will have Goldman Sachs branches, for example, across America, where you will be able to bank as a retail customer with Goldman Sachs. And it gives them more access to funding. It means that the Fed will be able to provide them with the same sort of funding that commercial banks currently have access to. At the moment, investment banks have had that funding for a very temporary, for a short period of time during this crisis. And that was due to be closed off at the beginning of next year. But now these two banks will have access to all of that funding forever.
So what would it mean on a day-to-day basis? Will staff be changing the nature of their jobs? Will there be job losses? How will it pan out for the people employed by the banks?
Well, the banks themselves are saying that they will carry on doing business as normal and that it won't affect their day-to-day business. Banks in America, obviously, if you have a nationwide network of branches, that could be a whole new area of funding.
But will they be competing with all the existing banks that are already there on American high streets, or would they be looking to take some of them over?
Well, I think they will in the medium term look to take some of these banks over. At the moment, those banks are very weak and there are all sorts of issues in these retail banks. Most of them probably aren't big enough and most of them have lent money mortgage holders who can't pay back, and many of them have bad loans on their books. So a lot of them will come up for sale in the next 12 to 18 months, and I think you could see Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley looking to buy a retail chain in this way, although I think they probably won't want to take on huge bad loans. I mean, that would be just another area of problems for them, so they would do their due diligence on these banks quite carefully.
And how have the markets reacted, and how would you expect them to respond to this going forward?
Well, interestingly, Wall Street opened quite down, and I think this is a reaction to the political wrangling that's going on in Congress over the $700 billion plan to bail out America's banks by buying up toxic assets from their balance sheets. There's some sort of political discussion about how that will go through Congress. The Democrats, for example, want to attach help for homeowners to that bill, whereas the Republicans want it to go through clean as is. And I think the market sees that uncertainty is a very bad thing. Markets, of course, hate uncertainty. And so there has been some selling of shares in the markets. And I think you would expect after a momentous week like last week to see some recovery in stock markets across the world. And we did see, of course, on Friday, a huge run-up in share prices, the biggest ever rise in London. I would have expected to see that reciprocated this week. It's obviously early days. We could see stocks recover later on in the week. But at the moment, things are still looking a little bit weak and uncertain.
Deborah Hargreaves there. And coming up later in the programme, after the first dig in 40 years at Stonehenge, archaeologists give us a new window on past events there. A Pakistani militant group by the name of Fidayeen-e-Islam has claimed that it carried out Saturday's horrific attack at the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad. The claim was aired in tapes made available to media organisations, and though not much is known about the group, it's thought they emanate from the tribal region of Waziristan near the Afghan border. Also yesterday, the Interior Ministry claimed that President Asif Ali Zardari and other senior members of the government were due to dine at the hotel on the night of the attack, but changed their plans at the last minute due to an intelligence tip-off. This has been denied by the hotel, but as The Guardian's Saeed Shah in Islamabad explains, questions are being asked about the alleged tip-off.
They are wondering why if there was intelligence to this effect, why it wasn't passed on to the hotel, which would have obviously got everyone out. I mean, there were 1,200 people at the hotel at the time of the bombing. And obviously the numbers injured and dead are high. I mean, they would have been higher if the truck had managed to crash right through the entry barrier. So they are asking that, but there are also questions about whether the government was really scheduled to dine there, because the hotel itself says it knows nothing about this booking. So there is a lot of confusion around that point.
Do you think that President Zardari's tenure is just going to be plagued with attacks like this?
I think almost certainly. I mean, he is being seen already as being as close to Washington as President Musharraf, his predecessor, was. And the fact that he's currently in the United States, where he's scheduled to meet President Bush today, that will not help him at all in this regard, that he's being seen as a kind of American toady. He's already articulated a kind of message on the war on terror, which is seen as a very kind of Americanized message. But actually, all he's saying is that this is now our war. And by taking on the extremists in this way, he's really opening himself up to their full wrath.
And so is this adding to an air of instability throughout the country? And are people beginning to hark back to the more stable days of Musharraf?
Well, I don't think that is taking place yet, but there is very much a very strong feeling in the country that something has changed for this last attack at the Marriott. And you know, there were a couple of terrible ones before this, and that the intensity of the militant onslaught has really risen several fold. And there's a huge sense of insecurity in the country. People are wondering whether it's safe to go out to shop, to markets. They're worried about family members when they leave the house. That there is a different change in Pakistan today.
And what can President Zardari do about it?
I think really he has to distance himself as much as possible from being seen as following a Washington-dictated agenda. He certainly has to pursue the militants, but he has to somehow make this struggle an indigenous one, to make it a Pakistani one. At the moment, it is seen very much as an American one, which means that he really doesn't have the people of Pakistan with him, because the militants claim they're fighting for Islam. They say that Zardari is fighting for America, and people in this country tend to believe that Zardari is on the American side on this. So the challenge really is to convince people that this is Pakistan's war, Pakistan is going to fight it, and it's going to fight it its own way, and that this has nothing to do with America.
Syed Shah in Pakistan. One of archaeology's most compelling mysteries, what Stonehenge was actually for, is now a little closer to being solved after Professors Tim Darville and Geoffrey Wainwright unveiled the findings of a small but revealing excavation they carried out earlier this year. They say they've discovered that the important blue stones at the site were brought there as early as around 2300 BC, 300 years later than previously thought. But they've also found that there was activity on the site much earlier, and that it may have been an important centre for healing. I asked Guardian archaeology specialist Maeve Kennedy what the professors were actually looking for.
They went down into a very small piece of ground, the size of a large hearthrug, trying to prove when the blue stones came from Wales. The blue stones are much older than the double-decker-sized famous trilithons of Sarsen stone, which actually were only brought from a mere, 25 miles away, easy peasy. The blue stones, which are smaller, were brought from 250 kilometres away in North Wales. It's such an extraordinary idea that they were brought to Stonehenge that people thought for years that they must have been swept along by glaciers. That theory is pretty much blown out of the water. Now, it does look as if human beings moved these stones for some very specific reason to Stonehenge. And these two archaeologists are convinced that the reason was that people believed that the blue stones had magic healing powers. They say that this belief in their healing powers endures in Wales, where the stones came from, to this day. And that for almost 1,000 years, more than 1,000 years after people believed Stonehenge had fallen out of use, that people still came there to collect little chips of this magic stone and to keep them as amulets against disease.
And there's evidence that there was activity on this site for long before the stones actually arrived, is that correct?
That's right. I mean, this is the most boring looking find from any archaeological excavation I can remember in a long time. What they found is a handful of bits of burnt wood and some little flakes of grey stone. Blue stone, I have to say, only looks blue when it's very newly split. Once it's been around for a while, it goes a very dull kind of grey concrete colour. But the little bits of firewood prove that there were people lighting fires at this site 7,000 years BC. It's just extraordinary. And the deposits suggest that this is, that these aren't house sites. These aren't fires that were lit all year round. These are fires that were lit on special occasions for some kind of feasting, some kind of midwinter feasting, perhaps for the winter solstice, perhaps again for the summer solstice. And that the site was already important to people at this ancient, ancient date. And that's why the stones were brought there. And the little bits of burnt wood also suggest that hundreds and hundreds of years after people believed that Stonehenge had been abandoned, people were still coming there for some kind of midwinter festival. The later pieces of wood I found fascinating because they're not oak and beech and the fires that you would burn on a summer bonfire. They're midwinter greenery. They're holly, ivy, yew branches, the sort of thing that would still be green in the landscape and you might gather up to bring with you to a winter solstice party, much as I've seen druids doing any year that you care to go around in December.
So what do you think this new evidence will add to the experience of the average visitor to Stonehenge? Stonehenge.
I think it increases the sense of wonder at the site, because if you go there, it's a lot of very big stones. What is extraordinary about Stonehenge is why? What was it there for? What did it mean to people? And the doors have just been cranked open so that the history of Stonehenge now stretches for thousands of years in either direction. This was a site that was fantastically important to people, that they were prepared to recognise that importance with the most stupendous human effort for a phenomenally long period of time. It's as if we discovered that the great pyramids in Egypt were still being used for the burials of kings 100 years ago. You know, an unimaginable void of time has suddenly been bridged by these little chips of stone and these little bits of firewood. They have found chips of the stone in burials quite close to Stonehenge, so it looks as if their theory that there was some belief that this stone had magic properties, like the Chinese buried bodies of great leaders in jade suits, because jade was believed to preserve the flesh forever. In the same way, they seem to have believed that this blue stone had special powers. Now, they've only been able to look so far, because this work is still going on. There's stuff out in laboratories all over the country. I've only been able to look at burials quite close to Stonehenge. They suspect that as they look further and further, they will find these little chips of stone, which people would have overlooked completely in earlier excavations, will have been buried with people perhaps who had been themselves on a kind of pilgrimage to Stonehenge, or whose families maybe had been to Stonehenge to look for a cure for them. And as you would bring a bottle of Lourdes water home, now in Ireland, in my Ireland, people still do it, to somebody who was too sick to travel, you might bring one of these little flakes back from Stonehenge to try and heal them, or at least ease their pain.
Guardian writer Maeve Kennedy. And that's all from us today. Today's podcast was produced by Sonia Rothwell and Tim Mabey. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.